This is our final topic within the philosophy range. And we've left philosophy of religion to the very end because in many ways this turns out to be a summation and climax of the course. And it naturally is of special importance here at Patrick Henry. In the area of philosophy of religion, there are two standard problems that are always discussed: the problem of evil and matters relating to God's existence. We have already dealt with God's existence in terms of classical arguments when we were talking about metaphysics and philosophy of science. But in the case of the area of God's existence, in the last 75 years, another aspect of this problem has turned up. And this has turned up chiefly because of the so-called analytical philosophers, the analytical philosophy movement. We're going to be saying a good deal more about that on Monday, but the meaningfulness question as to whether you can even discuss issues of God's existence needs to be treated, and we'll certainly be doing that. We want to begin with the problem of evil. We're going to go on into this meaningfulness of God language issue, then we want to move into the epistemology of religious experience. This we're going to do by taking a quick look at examples of world's religions and cults and liberal theological speculations to see if these can pass sufficient epistemological tests. And then on Monday, we're going to turn our attention to whether the case for Christianity is in a different category from these world religions, cults, and liberal theological speculations, and what kind of philosophical legitimacy lies in the case for Christianity. Right. Problem of evil. What is the problem of evil? Well, the Jehovah's Witness arrives at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday and wakes you up. Clearly, things are not quite right in the universe. But the problem cuts a little deeper than that. The problem of evil is stated as follows. If there is a good God who is all-powerful, then he would want to eliminate evil from the universe. And he'd be capable of doing it. If he's good, he'd want to be doing it. And if he's all-powerful, he would be able to do it. But clearly, we have the evil about us, and in spades. So, says the non-Christian, or the philosophical critic of theism, there just can't be such a God. Now, attempts have been made to deal with this problem by questioning God's omnipotence, to argue for a finite God, a God who is good and who would want to eliminate the evil, but who is simply not capable of doing so. The major example of this viewpoint is that of Edgar Sheffield Brightman, a personalist philosopher at Boston University a generation ago, E.S. Brightman. It was Brightman who argued for the finite God theory. This has not really had much impact. The point being that, you know, if God's doing the best he can, and that just isn't sufficient, it doesn't seem like it's very worthwhile for us to try to do anything. I mean, of course, we would want to help him out as much as we possibly could. But if he's incapable of getting rid of the mess, then it wouldn't seem as if any human efforts would have a great deal of impact. The finite God position, therefore, is not generally maintained. Well, what kind of answers are there for the traditional Christian theistic position that God is good and he is all-powerful, and yet it is not irrational that evil should exist? The best approach to this is an approach by way of the concept of free will. This has been developed by a number of philosophers. Plantinga, in his book God and Other Minds, has done very sophisticated work on this. In popular terms, the best thing on the subject is C.S. Lewis' little book, The Problem of Pain. The Problem of Pain. Now, the essence of this argument is simply that God didn't create evil, but he did create with free will. That is to say, he gave his creatures the ability either to do his will or to refuse to do his will. Free will, then, is uncaused. There's no sense in asking the question, well, what caused God's creatures to sin? Or what causes God's creatures not to sin? If the will is indeed free, it's uncaused. Okay? Now, if God did in fact give his creatures free will, and they decided to refuse to follow him, at that point, sin enters. Sin is simply the term we give for the misuse of free will. And once that happens, there are going to be consequences. And the consequences we call sins, plural, or evils, plural. Augustine was certainly wrong in thinking that sin is simply an absence of something. It isn't an absence of something on either level. It isn't an absence of something at the level of refusing to do God's will, because that is a positive refusal. So that's not an absence of something. And it certainly isn't an absence of something when you're looking at the consequences, evils. The evils are not an absence of something. Dachau and Buchenwald and the confounded Jehovah's Witness at the door on Saturday morning. None of these is an absence of something. It is a hideous presence of something, or an obnoxious presence of something. Okay, why did God give creatures free will? The answer to this is that he is a God of love. And love can't be forced. My standard example, Mrs. Schlonk, who will not let her son, Lemuel, do anything that could possibly get him into trouble, right? Sheriff's deputies hear that Lemuel has been in the attic until he's 31 years of age. And, of course, the child care people and the sheriff's department arrive, and Mrs. Schlonk is arraigned for this. and she appears on television in the evening. And the programmer says, "Mrs. Schlonk, I'm sure I'm going to ask you a question that every one of our listeners would ask you if they were here. Mrs. Schlonk, why did you keep Lemuel in the attic until he is 31 years of age?" Mrs. Schlonk says, "Because I love Lemuel more than other parents love their children. They allow their children to go out and get hit by baseballs and run over by cars. I wouldn't let that happen to Lemuel. I love Lemuel." And in the corner, there's Lemuel, and he's going, you know, Lemuel is crazier than a March hare because he's been in the attic. It is not a manifestation of love to keep people from making free decisions. It's exactly the opposite. Of course, the problem with this is that the creature can destroy himself or herself by the misuse of free will. But without the opportunity to make a positive, meaningful decision, there isn't any love relationship between God and his creatures. Now, to this, the critic will say, but couldn't God have allowed free will without having consequences come from this, like cancer and world wars and Dachau and the Jehovah's Witness and all the rest of it? Wouldn't it have been possible to have free will without the consequence? Answer, no, because free will and the results of it are intimately connected. The consequences must follow from the action, or there really isn't any significant free will at all. Example, we'll say that my granddaughter has been here from France. She's only 2 years of age. Her English is really limited. But let's say that she's now at 5 or 6 years of age, and what she loves to do is to go into my office and empty the ashtrays with cigar butts onto the Persian carpet and grind the ashes into the carpet. And I say, Sarah, son of a pa, we're not going to have this. And but still she keeps doing this. So I get Rube Goldberg-type devices installed behind the wood paneling in my study. And the minute that Sarah grabs an ashtray full of these cigar butts and begins to turn them over, mechanical arms come out from behind the woodwork and grab the ashtray and retract. The doors close. No consequences whatsoever. No matter what Sarah does in order to dump these cigar butts, she is unable to do it. Consequences are completely eliminated here. Now, under those circumstances, what's going on? This will quickly turn into a game. She will try to figure out a new way of pulling this off. It will no longer be a moral issue. The moral issue will disappear because there are no consequences connected to it. This is why, in any legal system, for example, punishment has got to be connected with crimes. You can't just declare that the defendant has done something wrong. You know, judge says, "Now, really, that act of cannibalism on your part is not the sort of thing that we like." And then the defendant goes off, you know, for a good meal. That's not going to be a moral context at all. Now, you may wonder why those cigar butts were in my study. It's because of the Calvinist friends I have, particularly from Grand Rapids, Michigan. They smoke these noxious cigars, and I try to be nice to them, Calvinists that they are, and that explains the cigar butts. I once tried to smoke a cigar myself, but I burned my nose and it was very uncomfortable, and so I decided against that. All right. Now, the critic comes back and he says, "Ah, but couldn't God have reduced the consequences somewhat? You know, the common cold, but not cancer. Limited wars where people throw rocks at each other, but surely not world wars with nuclear weaponry." Well, the fact of the matter is that if the non-Christian, the critic here, has refused to pay any attention to Revelation, as the Bible, as he certainly will have refused to do so, where does the non-Christian's moral standards come from? Where do those standards come from? If there's no transcendent source available for moral standards, the non-Christian is really not in a position even to describe what evil would be or what bad consequences would be. The non-Christian is totally at sea in this area because all the non-Christian has are social understandings of what is not pleasant or good or nice. So the non-Christian is in an extremely bad position to criticize God for not limiting the consequences, especially since the evils have come about through our human activity, our misuse of free will. Criticizing the Almighty at this point would be something like at the time of that awful garbage strike in New York City some years ago. Let's say there's only one garbage truck out cleaning up garbage. Incidentally, there's an episode of Monk, that wonderful program Monk, in which this garbage theme is the center of it. But let's say the garbage strike is going on and people are in their high-rises and they're yelling at the one person who's cleaning anything up and saying, "Can't you work any faster?" I mean, this would really be obnoxious because they're producing the garbage and they're complaining that somebody isn't cleaning it up fast enough. This is exactly like the unbeliever saying, "Well, why can't God limit this problem a little bit?" Okay. Then, connected with this philosophical issue, yes.
But isn't the person who is cleaning up garbage, they would be a finite being, whereas since God is infinite, he would be able to limit the consequences easily. It's not like we're
saying. Oh, yes, very definitely. And there we go back to the point that which I was trying to make in saying that the non-Christian didn't refer to Revelation or have any go to that for any of his understanding, that the degree to which the consequences are necessary and should not be limited would be something that he would know and not anybody else. I mean, the human being is not in a position to say that consequent A should be eliminated and consequent B is okay. So without any kind of eternal perspective on the thing and without the benefit of an infinite mind, it's darn hard to know which consequences are important and which ones aren't. The fact of consequences is clear enough. That's got to be present. The degree is another matter. And incidentally, if you're into a discussion with a non-Christian on this, this is an ideal place to do a little preaching, namely that according to Scripture, Colossians, it's in Christ the whole world holds together. If he removed his hand for even an instant, the whole thing would fall into nothingness. And God, therefore, by his grace, is allowing us to function even after the mess we've created. And according to Scripture, God does limit things. And ultimately, he will wipe away all tears from our eyes. And he even sent his own son to deal with this situation. So the fact of the matter is that, again, we're in a very bad position to try to criticize the good Lord for the stuff that we have done and the consequences that derive from it. Okay, related to this, but why are the good allowed to suffer? Okay, first point we've already made, non-Christian is in no position to define who's good and who isn't, because the non-Christian doesn't have any absolute standard of morality. We dealt with this kind of thing when we were talking about ethics. Secondly, from the standpoint of biblical revelation, nobody is good. Nobody is good. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Therefore, from within the framework of revelation, this question probably shouldn't arise. But outside of it, it's necessary to understand what is meant by evil or sin. Evil or sin, as we said, is the violation of God's will. Therefore, it is an irrational act, and it's going to produce irrational consequences. When the terrorist throws a bomb into a crowd to hit a political leader, the shrapnel goes all over the place, and there are people other than the political leader who end up maimed or killed. The consequences of sin are like this. It's that kind of a universe that's come about as a result of the misuse of God's will. That's why the mafia don dies in bed at 85 years of age with just after a champagne lunch, and the sweet little school teacher with young children is killed by a motorcycle coming down the road too fast. The irrationality of the thing arises from the nature of the problem itself. Okay, and finally, there is the question which is raised, not raised very often, because the philosophical critics are not very astute in the area of theology. Does this mean that there's going to be sin in heaven? Or there could be sin in heaven? Or there could be another fall? Does the fact that love implicates free will mean that there's always the possibility of things falling apart? Well, the theologians have argued as follows, that when the fall occurred and God determined to take this problem on himself, to die on the cross, to allow himself to be sacrificed, this was an act of such incredible nature that it forever altered things for those who believe in it. That is to say, it makes it possible for people who believe in this eventually to arrive at a point where they're not capable of sinning and therefore not capable of making another negative decision along the line of the decision of Adam. Now, some literary writers have gone a little too far with this. 19th century romantics developed the notion of the fortunate fall. The fall of man was really a neat idea because it resulted in a situation better than the situation that operated previously. My advice is don't follow that path. All we're saying here is that there is something unique about the way in which God solved this problem such that the problem is at least in theory able not to be repeated. And I give you an analogy for this. Theoretically, any two people who are married can get divorced. Okay? But you have probably noticed that people, that a husband and a wife who are married for, say, 30 years, begin even to look like each other, in a sense. Their reactions are the same. And the likelihood of their getting a divorce continually diminishes. Hmm? And the likelihood diminishes toward the limit of zero. Theoretically, that limit of zero is not going to be reached in this life, but we can certainly see that kind of thing taking place, and we can say the statistical chances of their getting divorced now are reducing virtually to nothing. Now, if as a result of the cross, it's possible to enter into a relationship with Christ, so beholding him as in a mirror, we are changed to his likeness, then one could well imagine that a subsequent fall would be out of the question. Okay, yes.
Could there have been a fall if God hadn't created the tree of the
non-human? Oh, sure. Oh, go ahead.
Could there have been a fall if God hadn't created the tree of knowledge?
Oh, sure, sure. He could have used anything, like a peanut, you know.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Whatever you eat, don't eat that peanut. What?
Why did God choose to place a temptation there or something that, like, God could have just not given any restrictions, like made all of the trees
Well, of course, if there were no standards presented at all, then how would it have been possible to exercise free will? Right? I mean, some kind of standard is necessary in order for the creature to decide either to love or not to love. Otherwise, you're in a vegetative state, sort of. You know, you're sort of like the baby who is not yet at the point of making a decision to love or not to love. To love or not to love always means that there are going to be choices involved in the situation, right? If you never go out on a date, the chances of falling in love are less, all right? Analogy.
Doesn't God love us unconditionally? Like, he doesn't have to choose?
Oh, sure, he does. We're not talking about his falling. We're talking about the creature falling.
Right. So there isn't any way that if we didn't have the option of sin, we couldn't love God unconditionally?
Well, that's the argument that you get in Plantinga and in C.S. Lewis, that the answer, no, there wouldn't be that possibility. And I think this is a pretty good argument. Now, in the last analysis, we are not presenting this thing as a 100% absolute deductive solution to the problem of evil. What we're doing is saying that these arguments are good enough that this should not be a sufficient reason for not facing the evidence that such a God exists anyway. I mean, so let's just say theoretically that you came to the conclusion that logically God shouldn't exist because of the problem of evil. Okay? But let's say that the evidence is overwhelming that he does exist. Then you've got that issue, which we've mentioned before, when consistency and factuality come into conflict. When they come into conflict, you always go for factuality, as in the case of the nature of light. You can't explain it in terms of consistency, but that's the evidence. So even if you don't think that this problem of evil is adequately solved, you still need to face the evidence that God exists. You know, and then tough on you for not being able to solve the problem of evil, not tough on God for existing. See the point? Okay, and fast, because I've got about 83 things to do today. Yes?
Okay, just about the, you said something to the effect that once man gets to heaven, it's possible that he can reach a point where he's incapable of sin.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, if this argument is correct, then how can real love be shown in heaven?
But see, it's already been created as a result of the creature's relationship with God in the context of choice.
Okay, so you have free choice and love's created, and then you hit no more.
Yeah, I know this is tough for some evangelicals who feel you've got to go down the aisle at every evangelistic campaign that takes place, but really, one conversion is just fine if it's genuine, and you know, there is one baptism for the remission of sins. Nicene Creed, everybody. Okay. Okay. All right. All right. Now I move on. I move on to this issue of the meaningfulness of talking about God. And here, if you go to the Tractatus, proposition 2.981, quoted there is the famous or infamous Flu Wisdom Parable. The Flu Wisdom Parable. This is a parable set out by the philosophers Anthony Flew and John Wisdom. And the essence of the parable is this, right? Two explorers come upon a clearing in the jungle. There appear to be in this clearing some evidence of order and also evidence of disorder. And one explorer, that's the believer, says there is a gardener who takes care of this. And the other says there is no gardener. That's the atheist. So they set up a watch. No gardener is ever seen. They put a barbed wire around the clearing and they electrify it. Nothing appears to cross the line, and so on. And at the end of this, the believer says, but there is a gardener, invisible, intangible, insensible to electric shocks, and he comes in secret to take care of the garden which he loves. And the unbeliever says, but how does that kind of a gardener differ from an imaginary gardener or no gardener at all? Okay? Now, the point of this parable is that if there is no evidence of God, there's no point in talking about God. The very concept of God becomes meaningless, and you can't even use God language effectively. The analytical philosophers who employed this approach used it to cut off any discussion of traditional arguments for God's existence, because the problem, according to them, is much deeper than whether the cosmological argument is sound or not. You can't even talk about this sort of thing meaningfully, because there simply isn't any evidence. All right? It is, in other words, the God language falls into the category of the meaningless or the nonsensical. Yes?
But isn't the order in the garden the evidence?
Well, see, there's both order and disorder. Okay? And the question is whether the order is so trivial that it's just by statistical chance. It's that sort of thing. Now, fascinatingly enough, Flu was eventually convinced by intelligent design. And 5 years ago, Flew became a believer in a creator, only a deist, not a theist or a Christian believer. He doesn't believe God intervenes in history, but he thinks that the intelligent design is now a sufficient argument for believing that there is indeed a creator, which is interesting. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of people in philosophical circles will not even discuss God questions because of the argument that to do so is to engage in meaningless discourse. Now, what can be said to this? Just about nothing if you are dealing with the religions of the world in general, the cults, or liberal theological speculation, because no one of these offer any substantial evidence or any evidence that is worthwhile to show that God talk isn't meaningless. And therefore, we move instantly, immediately, if not sooner, to take a look rapidly at these three categories. Okay? First, the religions of the world. And here I'm going to illustrate by way of Islam, and Buddhism really rapidly. Okay. Islam. What evidence is offered to show that there is one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet? There are no contemporaneous miracles in the life of Muhammad at all. There is in Muslim tradition the miracle of the Prophet's night journey. It so happens that Muhammad was the only human to be carried by night upon a heavenly horse from the sacred mosque in Makkah to the farthest mosque in Jerusalem. This, however, occurred instantaneously so that no one observed it. This is something like the fastest gun in the West. Would you like to see this? Fastest gun in the West? Would you like to see it again? See the point? Okay. Muslims say that the picture of the Bible, the picture of Jesus in the New Testament, is inaccurate. It was modified by the disciples or by higher criticism or that sort of thing. And the only things in that picture that are correct are the things that the Quran says about Jesus, or compatible with what the Quran says about Jesus. When asked why that's the case, the answer is because the Quran is the final revelation of God given to Muhammad. And when you then ask the question, why do you hold that the Quran is the final revelation of God given by Muhammad, the answer is because it's true, and you've got to start there in order to make sense out of anything. And that should recall some discussions of presuppositionalism that we had early in the course, right? This is an entirely presuppositionalist position. And it shows that you can take that kind of position no matter what your religious orientation happens to be. All right. What about Buddhism? Well, in the case of Buddhism, I suggest you take a look at my Giant in Chains, which deals with Chinese religion. My wife and I were over there at the time of the Tiananmen Square mess, and I did this book soon after that. Anyway, everything we know about Gautama Buddha comes from a small document written some 200 years later. The authoritative biographer in English of the Buddha says this, and I quote, if I can get the quotation here quickly, yes. In the present state of our knowledge, we cannot say in any instance that Buddha said so-and-so. The fact that we start from is that we have a collection of documents which were held some two centuries after Buddha to contain his utterances. In other words, we have no sound historical information about the Buddha whatsoever. Now, does that trouble Buddhists? No. Because Buddhism is not dependent upon any historical facts. It's dependent upon accepting the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And the essence of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path is that our problems arise from desires. Desires produce suffering. And therefore, the idea is to attenuate your desires, and then you will eventually, after various reincarnations, enter nirvana. Well, that's all very interesting, but why should one hold that? Why should one maintain that particular view of the cosmos? Why should one hold that there is any such thing as nirvana? Why should one maintain that all desires are unfortunate? You know, in the Far East, one of the reasons that there has been practically no social improvement and that the caste system continued as it did for centuries and does even today is that no distinction is made between good desires and bad desires. The idea is to avoid all desires, including a desire to do good, because any such desire will unfortunately keep you from entering nirvana as soon as you would want to do. Gandhi said the only reason that he arrived at the conclusion that outcasts should be protected and the caste system destroyed was because he went to a Christian school. He never became a Christian, but he admits in his autobiography that it was through Christian teaching that he understood the evils of this kind of approach. Okay, let's go to the cults. Scientology, our favorite cult because of the Hollywood stars who are involved. If Tom Cruise is in it, it's got to be all right. Yes. According to Scientology, millions of years, this comes from a court case in the Netherlands where the Scientologists got stuck good. Millions of years ago, Xenu, the evil prince who reigned over the galactic universe, solved a problem of overpopulation by transporting people to Earth and causing two atomic bombs to explode, one on Las Palmas and one on Hawaii. Clearly, these demons did not like nice holiday locations, right? Their souls, the Thetans, are still wandering the Earth. We are those Thetans, but we are dazed and deadened. You know, particularly whoever thought of this, that's L. Ron Hubbard. Anyway, Scientology teaches us how people can regain their abilities and can achieve the status of operating Thetan. An operating Thetan can control people with his thoughts far above average intelligence and can communicate with animals and plants. Talking to a kumquat, for example. Moreover, people have traumas, engrams, often acquired in previous lives, and Scientology can do away with them. Finally, there are body thetans that also cause a great deal of trouble, and followers can learn how to get rid of these. Unfortunately, there are an infinite number. See the written pleadings of Mr. Bakershut and the interlocutory pleadings, and so forth. Now, how could one possibly demonstrate or support any of this? This isn't right. It isn't even wrong. You want technical meaninglessness? You got it. In spades. Okay. Word about the Mormons. Joseph Smith in upstate western New York, not too far from where I was born, had an encounter with the angel Moroni. Golden plates were provided. He translated these plates, creating the Book of Mormon, and then Moroni conveniently took the plates back to heaven. The Mormons were left with his translation. This book states that the lost 10 tribes of Israel arrived in the Western Hemisphere, and they are the basis of Western peoples. Okay, and the Mormons today are allegedly inheritors of that tradition. Well, there is absolutely no evidence about the golden plates, none whatsoever. And recently, some DNA testing occurred, and I have an article here from the Los Angeles Times. DNA tests contradict the Mormon scriptures. The fact of the matter is that there is no evidence by DNA that there's any connection between American Indians or Mormons or anybody else and the ancient Israelites. None at all. And the Book of Mormon, which supposedly contains books that were written before the time of Christ, include New Testament quotations. And the New Testament quotations are from the King James Version, from the Authorized Version. Now, you know, this sort of thing is awkward. It's awkward. And this is why Mormons today will invariably talk about their wonderful community, the fact that they support marriage and family, and that there are wonderful spiritual experiences available to you. They won't get on to this stuff. And, you know, if I were a Mormon, I wouldn't get on that stuff. Yes?
Couldn't they just say that the quotations that were written before Christ, the quotations that were from the New Testament, couldn't they say that there was just prophecy?
Well, they could, I suppose, but it's odd that it would be prophesied in the language of the Authorized Version of 1611. I mean, I suppose you could say that this was because the Lord really likes the Authorized Version. He wanted to get them used to it early. But you know, this is a problem. No Book of Mormon cities have ever been located in the Western Hemisphere. No Book of Mormon names have been found in New World inscriptions. No genuine inscriptions in Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, have been found in America. No ancient copies of the Book of Mormon scriptures have ever been found. There is no mention of Book of Mormon persons, nations, or places anywhere else. No artifact of any kind has demonstrated the reliability of this material. Messy, 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 right? Okay. Now, finally, liberal theological speculation. I mentioned only two instances of this. Karl Barth and Paul Tillich, B-A-R-T-H, and Tillich, T-I-L-L-I-C-H. These are 20th century theologians who had staggering impact in the West. Karl Barth said, the resurrection of Christ occurred. It occurred, however, in supra-history. Supra-history. This in German is Geschichte. This is a specialized use of the term Geschichte, which you probably think of as just the word for history. But Martin Kaler, a German theologian of the 19th century, distinguished between Geschichte and Historia. Historia is ordinary history, the stuff that you investigate. Geschichte is salvation history or superhistory. All right, now, says Barth, the resurrection occurred. Yes, it was a factual resurrection. But it didn't occur in ordinary history, and therefore it is not subject to any kind of ordinary historical investigation. And that's why secular historians don't arrive at it. Okay? Now, as I pointed out in a debate with a Barthian some years ago, unfortunately, there are no criteria, therefore, as to what's going on in suprahistory and what isn't. For example, are people eating toasted cheese sandwiches in Geschichte? There will be no way to determine this whatsoever. They could be cucumber sandwiches. This is a realm where there is zero testability. Interesting, eh? Why did Barth do this? Because he accepted the historical criticism of the 19th century and didn't consider the New Testament material reliable in ordinary history, but he desperately wanted to believe in the resurrection, right? This is having your cake and eating it too. Paul Tillich. We need to approach God ontologically. Tillich's theology is called an ontological theology. Why? Because, says Tillich, God is being itself. God is being itself. Or, as he sometimes put it, the ground of all being. All right? Some unpleasant theological students used to call this the hamburger God, because it's the God, the ground of all being, right? Well, but anyway, when you look at this kind of theology, what does it say? Well, it either says that there is no difference between God and the world. God is being itself. If that's what he's saying, this is a variety of pantheism, right? But the trouble with that is it hasn't told you anything about the world. All it's done is given you another name for it. And we really didn't need that. We were perfectly satisfied to call it the world. Cosmos. Well, we didn't need to have another word for it. So that wouldn't tell us anything about God. And if God is the ground of all being in the sense of the source of it or the foundation of it, then what's the evidence that any such source or foundation exists? Then you're right back to all of those questions that we raised when we were talking about the existence of God. Okay, in sum, what do we have here? If you look at the religions of the world, you look at the cults, and you look at contemporary liberal theological speculation, you find that one of two things is the case. Either any evidence they present is appallingly inadequate. It's appallingly inadequate, so that nobody would buy what they're saying on the basis of that evidence. Or, and this is generally the case, what they're saying is technically meaningless. Nothing can count for it, and nothing can count against it, and therefore we are left simply with their claims. And if that's all there is in the area of religion, the philosophers of religion are quite right to go with the flu wisdom parable. Because that kind of a God can be an imaginary God or no God at all. Fortunately, Christianity is a totally different breed of cat from this. And that's what we're going to get into on Monday. We're going to see that Christianity alone can satisfy the philosophical requirements that we have talked about in this course. Okay? That's it.